Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. This season of Going There is also brought to you by AbbVie, who is driving the pursuit of better mental health. Over the last 30 years, AbbVie's scientists and clinicians have worked to tackle the complexity of mental illness, and today offer a portfolio of medicines and a pipeline of innovation that spans depression, anxiety, bipolar 1 disorder, and schizophrenia. To learn more about AbbVie's work to support individuals throughout their mental health journey, please visit www.abbvie.com or follow at AbbVie on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And also, this episode of Going There is brought to you by Alkermes. Alkermes is a global biopharmaceutical company developing innovative medicines in the field of neuroscience, with products that treat alcohol dependence, opioid dependence, schizophrenia, and bipolar 1 disorder. To learn more, please visit Alkermes' website at www.alkermes.com or follow at Alkermes on Twitter and LinkedIn. Today we are talking with singer-songwriter and musician Pete Laurie Wingfield of the band Until the Ribbon Breaks. You may know Until the Ribbon Breaks from their single My Love, their great cover of the Pretenders classic One Way or Another, as well as collaborations with artists such as Fantagram on the song Fall in Love. Until the Ribbon Breaks has a new album out now called Visitor, which includes the singles Nature Mother and Human. Check out Until the Ribbon Breaks music, tour info, and merch at untiltheribbonbreaks.com. Now on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And on this episode, Pete is talking about a cycle that unfortunately many of us face, which is the cycle of addiction where we struggle with anxiety and use alcohol to soothe that anxiety. Now, Pete uses a phrase that I really like that captures this cycle, which he describes as a snake eating its own tail. Now, many of us feel that our anxiety interferes with who we are or who we want to be. For example, if we are anxious in social situations and we wish to be more carefree and emboldened when we are with others, we feel that anxiety holds us back. And so in this context, we feel that if we have a few drinks, our anxiety will lessen. And in that moment, we will become less socially anxious and therefore more of who we want to be. And for a time, this cycle works. The problem is that over time, two things happen. First, as we drink more, our tolerance for alcohol increases, and therefore we need to drink more to reduce our anxiety. And second, while drinking alcohol initially soothes our anxiety, as time goes on, it may actually make us more anxious when we are not drinking. Many of the symptoms of a hangover mirror anxiety symptoms, as we often feel weak, disoriented, agitated, and confused. And so we get into a cycle whereby we need to keep drinking more and more as our anxiety grows, and we need more alcohol to have an anxiety-reducing effect. And ultimately, we become addicted to alcohol, and the ongoing cycle of using and withdrawal makes our anxiety even worse. Now, ideally, early in this process, we realize what is happening and we pull back on how much alcohol we are drinking and try to find other ways to manage our anxiety. But like so many things in our lives, if it works for a while and then stops working, we feel like the best answer is to push a little more. If we were getting good grades with how much we were studying and then our grades drop, we feel that we should study a bit more. If we diet and exercise to lose weight and our weight plateaus, we feel we just need a bit more diet and exercise. And unfortunately, for many of us, years of drinking calms our nerves, And if that effect stops, it only makes sense that we just need to drink more and more. And soon we are, as Pete says, the snake eating its own tail, desperately trying to pursue a strategy that used to work, but doesn't work anymore, and just makes things worse and worse. In our discussion, Pete talks about how he recognized this pattern and confronted his anxiety and addiction. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so they can go there with us. So let's go there and listen to what Pete has to say.
Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa.
Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mother's Bathroom Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
Hey, Pete, welcome to Going There.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start off with a song of yours that you've written that you feel like most epitomizes your mental health journey.
Love that. Just straight in. What a question. I mean, all of them. you can chart through probably the peaks and valleys. The one that's probably most meaningful for me in that regard is a song called May Root, which is the first song I wrote after getting sober, and wrote it at the place where I had got sober, which was in Thailand. So meaningful for me in a multitude of ways, because obviously the nostalgia and the memories that it evokes for me, just in terms of where and feeling like maybe I couldn't even ever write a song again. So yeah, it's a song called May Rue.
Do you feel comfortable just talking about the history of your addiction, just to bring us up to the point then of understanding the sobriety?
Which in itself always feels miraculous, you know, that that's the answer. And I don't take that for granted. But charting back, and this is obviously something that came up in program a few times, is that I don't actually know the point in which I guess I was fixated on some form of self-medication. There's addiction in my family. Both my parents are musicians, you know, say no more. But one definite point where I can kind of look at and say, oh, that's where something started. There was a lot of weed, smoking a lot of weed in teenagers. I was a skateboarder, and that was just a big part of that culture, at least with my friend group. But it never had the effect on me that I could see that other people were having. I really wanted it to, but kind of immediately it made me feel this new kind of social anxiety, which I hadn't experienced before. And I think it just sent me, and you know, it's one of those things, it's not the weed itself, it was obviously a catalyst for things that were dormant and would have come out anyway. And it just made me suddenly feel so conscious of who I was and in relation to the world and everybody else, which became paranoia and anxiety. And then one day, someone said, alcohol, that does the opposite. That makes you feel socially confident. And I remember drinking and going, oh, the cure. Fast forward 20 years of absolute chaos. The most insane thing to me is that then you end up, or I ended up choosing a profession in which there I am self-medicating for things like social anxiety and generalized anxiety, and then choosing a profession where I'm standing on stage saying, judge this thing I'm doing, or at least that was my perception of it, and putting work into the world where you're saying, tell me what you think of it and don't hold back. So that just catapulted and spiraled, you know. It was just the snake eating its own tail at that point. Like, everything I was doing to try and combat this feeling was perpetuating the feeling itself. More anxiety, more self-medicating, more anxiety, and just, you know, that just spiraled and spiraled. And it was all just so in secret, you know. I was definitely outwardly kind of, oh, we're like a proper band. We go on tour and we drink and we go out every night. And then always secretly I'd be drinking more and staying up later and getting up, by the end, getting up in the morning to drink, to just to drink myself to zero so that I wouldn't just be a walking anxiety attack. And then the worse that got, the more secretive it became. And it just, there's no ever, in my experience, there's no good ending to that. No one says, and then I woke up and it was fine. You know, you're just walking into a fire, basically. You know, my rock bottom, there were so many along the way, but it, as often is the case, it needed for me to kind of feel that myself. And I just completely lost my way, that, you know, I had no desire to make music, so I was kind of making music secretly, not even being present, let alone stand on a stage. Just turmoil in personal relationships, and it had reached a rock bottom where I was drinking, to be completely frank, I was drinking mouthwash. That in itself is a rock bottom enough for anybody. That was 7 years ago in January. Obviously, along the way, so much turmoil, but I'm not going to bore you with the gory details.
You know, one thing that's very tough for people is that, you know, at the beginning of that journey, you know, you talk about what alcohol can do for you. It can calm your nerves. It can, you know, make you feel more social. I mean, there are so many things that we get from alcohol, which is why we go to it. And do you remember what was good about it at first, and when you started to notice, hey, something's different now, this thing that's kind of worked for me, either it's not working for me, or it's not working as well, or it's working, but there's other complications.
Absolutely. The first half of that, I very, very distinctly remember the feeling of confidence. It was such a new feeling to me. Social confidence, you know, I felt invincible. Like, because the thing that had always held me back so much was this feeling of being on the outside. Straight away it worked, you know, the drug worked straight away, where I just was confident and therefore in some warped thinking, but, you know, reasonably at the time, I felt like more myself than I ever had. It felt like it wasn't a kind of fake version of me. It removed this block. It was years and years and years until it turned on me, I would say. What's that amazing expression? First you take a drink and then the drink takes you. That was a very clear moment. And for me, it was a physical thing. I had always felt anxiety. Didn't know what it was. Didn't have that term or expression. Knew nothing about the kind of clinical side of it. Just felt so discombobulated. And I think I'd been having small versions of anxiety attacks, even from when I was a small child. You know, that feeling of suddenly everything's just in the distance and you can't quite get it and you're dizzy and various physical ramifications, tremors and shortness of breath and all of that and confusion and terror, and you can't understand what you're so scared of, which then perpetuates it. And then discovered alcohol and that was lifted and I couldn't believe it. And then there was a very clear moment where I started waking up in the morning and with the worst anxiety I'd ever had to an extreme degree. And it was always the same physical sensation for me. I felt like my neck would uncontrollably shake. And then, you know, that brings on the snowball, you know. I start worrying about that. And then I'm notice hyper aware of every part of my body. And then, in the thinking that you're in that state was, oh, I'll just drink again. You know, completely, completely unwilling to see any logic of, well, that caused that, so don't do that. It felt completely logical to do more of that, you know?
Yeah, it's just, and you know, again, talking about the logic, and always people can look back on and sort of say, oh, where was the logic? But the logic up until that moment, based on what you're saying, is, you know, I'm functioning okay, I'm doing okay, but I have some anxiety. This makes me feel really good. It's making me feel really good for years. And I'm not having that much downside. Mm. And then now all of a sudden it starts. And people assume like, oh, I should have been able to know exactly at that moment that it was the alcohol and what am I doing and why would I make the choice? But in anything that we do, if something works for us, we kind of keep going back to it. I mean, people who get stress injuries from exercise, you know, you're not feeling horribly about yourself, but exercise feels really good and you're just doing it and you're doing it and you're doing it. And one day you wake up and your knee's hurting and you don't immediately think, oh my God, exercise is so bad. The exercise is the cause of all this. I have to stop. You think to yourself, no, like, you know what? Let me just kind of keep going. Like maybe this can work itself out, you know? And it, people, when they come to substances, it's as if none of us have ever done anything repeatedly that worked at one point and then stopped working. Relationships, friendships are all like that. You know, they're working. And then we're expected to, at the minute that it stops, you should know and you should give up on the whole thing. And it's very hard when you have a relationship with a substance like that has been working for you to just automatically for years on a dime that morning say, the panic is caused by my drinking. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I have to stop drinking. It's like you did to some degree the quote unquote rational, logical thing based on your experience. By the way, based on a lot of people's experience. And that's how quickly all of a sudden, how subtle it can be though. But I feel like we beat ourselves up as though we should have known something that we don't know in most other areas of our life.
Totally, totally. And I love that analogy that I hadn't correlated that. It's exactly like specifically friendships and personal relationships. Because there's also, I think, a massive fear in, you know, to use that relationship analogy, which I love, is I don't want to be without you. Even though you might, I definitely knew at some point, because it's rational, but you're not in a rational state. But there's also that thing of But I love how you make me feel when we're good together. So if I can just get through these mornings. So yeah, that's a perfect... We're just in a bad relationship.
Everybody says when a relationship ends, they look back, oh, there were signs. It's like, man, there are signs in every relationship from the moment it begins. In the first month, you know why you're going to break up with someone, if you're going to break up with them. It's all there. It's just the question of does the bad stuff get better and does the bad stuff mellow and does the good stuff get better? But it's the same thing with substances. It's like, you know, there is just this way that we're so judgmental of people who struggle with this, again, as though people should have known. And the truth is, as far as I'm concerned, is that the main difference between what happened to you and what happens to other people who maybe don't fall into the grips of addiction is probably genetic and biological. It's like you're probably doing a lot of the same thing that other people are doing, and just one day you wake up with that and they don't, and that's it. And it's like, but you know, obviously it gets much more complicated in terms of the effects. Mm-hmm. The effects become much more dire. But it's very hard, I think, for people because it compounds the pain of recovery. That constant judgment, that constant shame, again, as though we should have known. And it's like, I don't personally think it's fair. It adds this whole layer to people. Like, it's one thing to take responsibility and try to look at the facts, but it's another thing to say, but I was looking at the facts at that moment, and that's how I made that decision. You know, you can't all of a sudden say, oh, you were totally irrational because your judgment happened to lead in a direction that ultimately did not work. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, that there's something about that I just feel so counterproductive to people's recovery process.
Yeah, totally. And if I track it back now, so much of probably the reason it went on so long is that fear of judgment. And this is before, by the way, and I, you know, it's incredibly encouraging. So much is said negatively about social media and etc. But one thing that's for sure is a positive is open discourse. Because this is before any of that. It was social media was a lot more kind of presenting a certain life rather than the raw, honest truth about people's individual struggles. And so there was so much shame. You know, so much shame, which is why it was all done in hiding and then compounded by what I chose to do professionally.
And it's so interesting because it's, you know, this concept of the relationship with alcohol, the relationship with our feelings, you know, the relationship we have with shame. You know, it's kind of like it's kind of like when you're in a relationship with someone, you're like, all right, listen, so I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to hear what you're saying. You're saying that I'm doing something bad. I should feel badly about that. Okay, I can hear that. You know, I can hear that once. I can hear it twice, like three times. But you're not going away. The shame just stays. And it's almost as like, it's like, what do you want from me? Is the end game to keep me in a sense of shame? Because it's almost like a bully where it's kind of like, okay, if I give you my lunch money, to the extent that people have those, that anymore, but I'm dating myself there.
I did.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, if I give you my lunch money once, are you going to stop? Is this over now? Okay. You shamed me once. Is it over? And it's like, the answer is no. The answer is that shame is like fire. It just finds places to feed. It's always going to look to grow. And it's interesting because I wonder, I think for myself, it's like, what am I trying to do with the shame? And it's like, I'm trying to change some kind of behavior or have some kind of like moral cleansing, you know, that if I shame myself enough, I'll regain my sense as a good person, which, by the way, is one of the best things about recovery programs, because I feel like they create almost like what feels at times like, I don't know if a cleansing is the right word, but there's like a reanimation, a reconnection with our sense of humanity that doesn't require shame.
Oh, chills.
You know what I mean? And that's because that's what I think it provides as much as anything. That like a person who's like 30 years sober, and everything seems like it's going great in their life, and a person who's not even sober yet but comes to their first meeting is like, and has done things that they consider to be horrible things, maybe are horrible things, and there's a connection there. Everyone can see each other
in
that. I mean, that is so powerful.
Totally. That was such an impactful thing to me in those rooms, because all I ever wanted was a fix. I thought if I could have a drink, I'd be cured of anxiety. And exactly like you said, I thought equally when I got sober, once I get through this really hard bit, I'll never feel a negative feeling again for as long as I live. I don't even buy into the idea that this is a kind of something that addicts or people who suffer with mental health things deal with. It's human nature. Whatever we call that voice in our head is just by proxy of being a human being. And I think that for me is the lifelong mission. Like you said, is to not, the mistake I always have made is to say, how do I get rid of it? Whereas one of the most impactful things to me along this journey has been, what do you want? Maybe we could figure it out. Are you scared? Are you trying to protect me? Are you my friend? Why is it never a positive thing you say to me? Why isn't the voice in my head saying, great job, Pete? Why are you trying to keep me small? Because I'm always having to fight you. But we could do this together. So I've spent, you know, that's the journey. And like you said at the end about meetings, it was actually really encouraging to realize there is no answer to that question. So there'll be someone who's been sober for 30 years having exactly the same dialogue in their head with someone who arrived on the first day, which could be for a newcomer or anyone to discover that terrifying. Oh, so I never solve this? I definitely felt like that, but along the way, it's actually been incredibly freeing to just, okay. Because I think, like a bully, if you just treat it with a bit of a disparaging shrug, it gets bored. And even the distance to call it rather than me was a huge change for me. You know, I'm not anxious. There is an anxious part of me, or whatever you want to say, was a huge thing for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's just with the bully concept. It's like, because there's obviously certain severe cases where the damage being done is in and of itself mm-hmm. very problematic. But oftentimes when there's a bully, the bullying part is very quick and minor, and not, it's the shame that we feel all the way through from having been bullied that's so problematic. You know, it's like, all right, you took my money. Like, you know, okay, it's not that much money on a given time, or you pushed me into a locker, or you said something mean to me. These are all things that are, you know, sort of contained in time and sometimes contained in scope, but it's that shame. It's that shame. It's saying like, you should have done something, you should have done this. And it's almost like you want to say to it, it's like, okay, you're not helping. Like you're not giving suggestions. You're not understanding what I'm going through. You're just basically heaping on. Mm-hmm. And now something that had like, you know, it had kind of a negative effect at a 3 now has like at a 12, because you won't shut up in my head, you know, and it's constant. The bully is gone. The bully's gone and went to sleep. But, you know, we're up at night together, like replaying that and going over it. And it's just like, ugh.
We give it so much power. And I wonder, like, what do you think? Because this is the eternal question for me. And, you know, I've done various forms of therapy across the board over the years, of trying everything from a shaman in a jungle to CBT, like everything. And partly because I also find this incredibly fascinating. So is that, do you think that's a parental voice?
My general model with shame is that shame is kind of, on the one hand, it's horrible in and of itself, but it's also like sort of, how did it become horrible? It's like, like I think for myself, when I find myself talking about something in a way where I'm listening to myself, like, whoa, I'm like, you are going so far beyond where this needs to go. And usually, whether it's fair or not, I feel like it's because no one's listening. So it's like, I've got to amp up the volume. I've got to say it in a more severe way. I've got to give multiple examples just to be heard, which I'm not particularly proud of. And I don't think is a particularly adaptive way of doing things. But my, I think people often will operate that way. It's like when they are saying things, if they feel heard, if they feel understood and they feel like something's being dealt with, at some point things will work themselves out. It's when that's not happening. Someone's dismissing or being avoidant or whatever it may be. And so my general model of shame is that it's like the worst case of that process, right? It's the worst case of us not listening to ourselves talk about, like, hey, let's try to have a constructive conversation about what happened with the drinking. It's like, there's nothing wrong with if I did something wrong. If I miss something that I want to learn from, or I was stubborn in a way or willful in a way where I should have, you know, or I not should have, you know, because that's not a great term, but I wish that I would have, you know, done something different. It's like, that can be a really helpful conversation if I'm willing to listen. And so, you know, unfortunately, getting back to the parent thing, I do think that unfortunately sometimes parents set up a model where that dialogue doesn't happen. You know, if you get a bad grade or you don't clean your room or you make some kind of mistake, or oftentimes when people have mental health issues as kids, you know, where they're depressed or they're anxious or they have attentional issues and the parents are just, you're not getting better. And the kid isn't necessarily not listening. They just don't even know what's going on for themselves. So that's one of the ways that I think for people who struggle with their mental health, it can definitely develop. Is that, you know, no one knows what the answer is, and the parents sometimes, and even the, you know, the kids, like whoever's dealing with it, just get so riled up that it feels like, all right, if I shame them that one more time, now they're going to get it. You know, like that, like classic intervention, you know, get everybody in a circle and like shame them until they realize, oh, I hadn't considered, you know, thanks for telling me. Like, I hadn't really considered like that my 17 DUIs and like all the fights that I'm getting into and the fact that my liver doesn't work anymore. Like, now that you made me feel really badly, now I'm really going to pay attention. And it's like, I don't mean to demean that, because I, you know, for some people it may have worked, but it's not necessarily optimal.
No,
you know?
It certainly didn't work for me. It made me go push harder. But then, you know, it's incredibly complicated for the people on the other side of your behavior, right? Because also it doesn't work necessarily to be super soft. Because then you think, well, it's not an issue then. It can't be that much of an issue. So for me, again, my experience and things I've seen in other people, like I said, it's the moment where you have let yourself down rather than the expectations of other people. It's when I knew I didn't recognize, forget myself, like the person I even thought I might be, like any sense of that is just obsession with drink, which, you know, by proxy is obviously nothing to do with that, because it's all just so, for good or for bad or negative or positive, it's all just so self-absorbed, you know. And that's probably the thing that I felt, and since getting probably afterwards have felt the most kind of shame around, is the chaos you leave behind, which is the shame you end up with. And I think through all the journey and all the ways I've tried to combat it and think about it and learn about it. One thing I find kind of interesting and also encouraging is that it doesn't matter the method in which you choose. You know, everyone's going to have an opinion. Like, oh, that's woo-woo, or that's not woo-woo enough, or that's too theory, whatever. Is like, ultimately, at the core of all those teachings, I think, is just a lesson about letting go and forgiving yourself in order to see the world. Like get out of here. I think it's all just a way to try and get to that, a bit of peace. And I think that's a lifelong, you know, it, obviously, saying that, it's still like, why am I not peaceful enough? You know, what can I take that'll give me more peace? I think, but it's forgiveness for that too, that's in our nature, you know, whether, like, I'm not a monk, you know.
Well, no, I think... When you talk about letting go, one of the things I think about, depending on, you know, which, you know, you talked about CBT or different different approaches, is you know, at the end of the day, everything is always an experiment, and everything can be, you know, when you're stuck, there can be an experiment there, you know. So again, like with exercise, people think like, oh, should I run this much, or should I lift this much, or should I swim this much? And it's like, if you think to yourself, it's like, listen, at the end of the day, it's all going to be some kind of experiment. And if you can set that experiment up and say, listen, you know, you may not be ready for sobriety quite yet. You might not, you know, you might not be ready for it. And, but you might, it might be at you and be like, well, is there an experiment that you can do that'll make you think about it? Can you take a day? Can you take 2 days? Can you take a week? You know, maybe you can't take an hour.
That's yet. A really, wow. Got something that's, I've never even considered that, because that never seemed like an option, but that would be revolutionary, because it's, I think one of the things that stopped me getting sober for so long was the size of the mountain I knew it was going to be. I never even conceived that I would see what it was like to take 3 days. It was either I'm going to die from this, or I can never do it again. Which may or may not be true, but the method to getting to that realization maybe didn't need to be so black and white. So I think that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, it's very, and because then again, the shame starts to feel less relevant, because you think to yourself, well, if I'm already going to try, you know, kind of like, again, in a conversation with your shame, it's like, well, I'm trying the thing you said. Why are you still talking?
Yeah.
Like now shift to, if it's so important to you, right? Which is sometimes what we almost think to, you know, a family member or someone that we feel like is kind of shaming us. It's like, all right, so I heard what you said. I'm considering getting sober. How do you have, I mean, now that you've brought me to this horrible place, you know, or you've like, you know, where I feel like so badly about it, like, do you have ideas? Do you have suggestions? Can you address my fears? You know, how am I going to feel like myself? How am I going to ever feel social again? By the way, all my friends drink. You're telling me now, you and I became good friends, like, drinking all the time. Now you're telling me I can't drink. What's our friendship going to look like? I don't think we've hung out like half a dozen times sober in our entire lives. And you're telling me I got to stop drinking?
Exactly.
Now let's talk about solutions.
Exactly.
You know?
And maybe that's not, maybe that's a hard thing to conceive if you haven't suffered from a kind of all consuming addiction, is absolutely that. It's not like choice. It's not like, I'm gonna, you know what, I might take away dairy from my diet. Because if you took dairy out of your diet, you don't have to change every other aspect of your life. Whereas when I had to, not choice, had to stop drinking, exactly like you said, everything had to change, everything. And that's so terrifying.
Yeah, one of the best things in prepping for our talk that I read that you said, learning everything new after addiction. Everything has to be new. And I think I was like, wow, I was like, that right there. It's like that really hit me that I think so many people, it's like you said, it's not like you just remove one thing and everything else. It's like the context is very similar to when people have anything with their mental health, or their depression, their anxiety, an eating disorder. A lot of people struggle with getting over an eating disorder in part because they're like, what am I going to do with my time now? Do you know how much time I've spent thinking about my body, my shape, my eating, what people think of me? Now, that may seem like, well, that's a lot of negative stuff that's moving away, and that is true. But then it's sort of like, okay, but like, who am I? I've been this person since I can remember. And it's like, who am I when I'm not in the throes of addiction? If the belief system is that I'm always an addict, okay, mm-hmm. So I'm always an addict, so I'm always going to be struggling with things. But still, it's very different. Like, how many hours in the day are available not drunk? Like, it's just like, wow, like, who am I now?
Exactly. And they, you know, what's the wording is, which I think is perfect, is it's removing an obsession. And in the true definition of the sense, obsession is that for however many years it was, decades, it held the puppet strings of my entire existence. Who and where and why, everything. So you remove the obsession. It's not, oh, it's like you said, who the fuck, who am I?
Yeah, the absence of negative.
You like looking around. Yeah. It's like a scene in a movie where you wake up in a hospital room after an accident and but obviously it's a very needed and it ends up being an incredibly beautiful, a difficult and beautiful process, as it should be. Like, you've created the mess. There's also an element of responsibility that in the end becomes incredibly important and was to me, you know, especially as a musician. I'd have done anything to avoid any responsibility. Anything. It's the opposite. I want to do whatever I want at any time. And then suddenly, firstly, you're responsible for the mess you've made. And now you have to be... There's a slight misconception, and one that I think you hold, or at least I did, getting sober, is that, so when is it, when do I get the cash and prizes? I've done all this work to get sober. When will I get that amazing, perfect life and career? And it's a hard and amazing lesson to learn that what you've done ostensibly is get back to the place where everybody else is when they wake up in the morning and they go, oh, I can't be fucked with my day today. That's the prize. The prize is real life. And at the beginning, it's like, that can't be good enough. That is not a good enough prize for what I've just gone through to get sober. And I think that thought alone sends people back into drinking and alcohol, because that's the reality. No, now you just have to be normal.
It's like I have felt my best self drinking. I have felt like, you know, I have no responsibility drinking. I feel like I'm still, things are, I have a musical career drinking. I have all these things drinking. And now what you're telling me is all that I get from that is the chance to try for those things.
And feel the feelings that come along.
And feel all the feelings that, and by the way, a lot of times all the feelings that you didn't even know you were avoiding necessarily just weren't happening, because it's like, you know, you're not as bored when you're drinking, you're not as empty when you're drinking, not as lonely when you're drinking. You don't feel the anxiety as much. And it's a very tough thing. It's unfortunately the part is that what we don't think about is that, like, well, because we think all those things at the beginning, but it's time limited, right? It's time limited. Like, it's that, that's the part that I think is tough, is that you're always thinking to yourself, you know, I can do this for a little more.
Oh.
And you can until you can't, yeah. You know, and like something happens where it's like, now I really can't do this anymore. Or yeah. I really, you know, realize I shouldn't do this anymore.
Absolutely. And that I'm like all of us, I do that. I play that game every day of my life. Every Monday is when I'm going to start going to the gym. Every Monday, you know, it's Monday today. I'm not going to the gym. But you know, it's that those mental gymnastics, I think we all play all the time. It's just that when you're, when I was using, it's the stakes are higher.
You know? Yeah. And that's one of the things that I just hope for with mental health discussions is that people start folding in that quote unquote normal logic, normal thoughts, normal things to mental health things. Now, obviously addiction can be a little bit trickier because, like you say, the consequences for someone and their family, oh, you don't go to the gym, right? It's like, chances are you're not going to like have a heart attack or a stroke or develop diabetes tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a longer term process. Whereas if someone's drinking or someone's using, it's like, hey, every day, who the hell knows like what's going to happen. So obviously it's not the same in terms of the risk, but again, just sort of normalizing those processes and people trying to figure things out. I think reducing the shame, like, you know, not making it like it's such a different set of thought process. This person's crazy. This person's wacko. It's like, no, they're making decisions in the same way that the quote unquote normal people are making decisions in their life. It's just about something that not as many people understand.
Totally. And I think there's like an entitlement to wanting like absolute joy 100% of the time. And you know, I hope none of this comes across as that in some way it wasn't all worth it, because part of my journey, it's not something I talk about or advocate because it's such a personal thing, is one of the things that happened to me during my sobriety was I went and did ayahuasca in Thailand, and I very much researched it, prepared for it for months and months and months, and knew it was just going to be a one-time thing. It's hard to quantify in words what that experience was like, but I can say that the switch that I felt after it was that sense of, and I never know how to sum it up, but I did see a Ricky Gervais stand-up special where he said it better than me, and it was just this moment where he said, he was talking about why he doesn't need God and religion, and he was just saying, we are always looking for more, and there's got to be more, but have you ever seen a fucking jellyfish? And it was that sense of if you find just one moment in the day, and I try to, even if I have to force it, where you go, oh, all of this is completely miraculous, crazy, nuts, which makes the bad part of it part of the magic too. It's like this, a yin and yang thing. It can't work without it. None of it can work without each other. So there's just such a release in that, of like it all, it's all, and even much more simple than everything's going to be okay. I think that's none of our business. It's more just like everything is exactly as it is, and in that is just, well, fuck it then, you know. There's such a freedom in that and a beauty in that, and it's just that if I can find a bit of that once a day, then that keeps me sober.
And so on that point, let me just pivot, because one of the things that we tend to end up with is that process that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that thing of like what's out there. A lot of people will begin that process, whether intentionally or not, with music.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like listening to, I mean, I will never be able to listen to all the music that already exists. Like, I probably won't be, I mean, forget it. I mean, I will not be able to listen to 1/1000th of all the music that exists. And I obviously would love all new music, new music, new music. But for a lot of people, music is that first way that they think, oh, there's something out there that's more than them, that higher power concept, that there's a bigger world out there. And that helps them with their mental health journey. Were there any artists, songs, albums, concerts where you were like, okay, this was crucial in my mental health journey? That whereas we talked about at the beginning, kind of one of your songs, like someone else's stuff.
Absolutely. I love that question. Because music for me was always incredibly private. I was, you know, there was always music in my house, but for me it was finding like my parents' record collection, because I was hit with music all the time. Like, they were practicing their instruments, and so, you know, for a while it was kind of a pain in the ass. So it took for me to discover it on my own. And so throughout my life, there's been, so it was always a very personal headphones thing. And to answer your question, I think it's still my obsession, is, which is why I've always tried to do the film thing as well, is that it always was for me. It frames the world in a more cinematic and meaningful way. I think even through the drug use and alcohol, I just wanted to feel like there was something cinematic happening. And you could, you know, higher power is a way to say that, or there was just something less mundane, and the idea that it's not just random chaos. And I think when I first put certain records on, it felt important in a way that we were tapping into something, rather than it was something that we can control. The first record that did that was Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd, and I was way too young to care, know, or anything about it, or how it worked, or why it worked, which I think is the perfect way to... It's why, like, discovering music as a kid is so important, because all I cared was how it made me feel, and I couldn't believe it. So you could put them on, I'd get on my skateboard, I'd put my headphones on, and I wasn't me in this shitty little town. I was like anywhere I wanted to be. And so that, I think that was the first alcohol, because that's what I was trying to do with that. And so it's been so amazing to like get back to that, you know?
I think it's really cool that with the Pink Floyd, because the only time I've ever seen Pink Floyd or Roger Waters was the Roger Waters solo a few years back. And interestingly, I left being like, who on earth is playing with them? There's like this group, and it was Lucius.
Oh.
And then for you to then actually collaborate with them.
Yes.
And I remember I think I'm not on social media anymore, but back I think I sent them. So I've just been like, I was like, I don't know, because everyone's obviously it's Pink Floyd, but I was like, you guys were unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. And it was like, and so I personally, just the fact that that was the record that you went to, and then all
even,
the way.
I've never put that together. And
I,
wow.
Yeah. Oh, I just think that's cool. I'm psyched for you that just to have that like arc. You know what I mean?
Well, I'd never put that together, so thank you. Now I have that up. But, I mean, talk about what we're talking about with Lucius. So we did it in the studio. I kind of refuse to, as much as is possible, to ever do a collaboration that's like email or something. You know, I'm just always fans of these people. So I want to be a spy. But they, more than anyone else I've ever seen, have tapped into some kind of symbiosis. When they record, it's the same mic. It's not just a gimmick they do live. And you know, initially you're worried, like, well, how will I be able to mix them or time them? Not an issue. It's just one thing. It's not like they even say, which harmony are you going to do? They just go, and here's Lucius. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I listen, Pete, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been so great talking with you. I know a lot of people are going to be helped by you sharing your story, and it's been great to get a chance to become more familiar with the music, and I look forward to following your career. I hope we get a chance to talk again.
Oh, I would love to. And I just want to say, like, thank you so much for what you do. It's so important. When I was, you know, earlier in my career, I was always wondering why there wasn't enough of this, and it's so needed in music. And thank you so much for creating a platform where people can be honest about this stuff.
Absolutely. So there it is. Pete Laurie Wingfield of the band Until the Ribbon Breaks, talking about his struggle with anxiety and addiction and how he felt like a snake eating its own tail. Now, there's so much to take away from the conversation with Pete, but one thing I want to focus on was something Pete had said in a previous interview that he and I discussed in this episode, which is the notion that when we recover from addiction, everything has to be new. And this is an experience that many of us have when we struggle with mental illness. When we are in the throes of addiction, depression, or anxiety, or whatever we're facing, we want so desperately to feel new in that we want to get rid of these horrible thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And yet, when we do so, and when we recover, we have often struggled with these experiences for so long that we are often left feeling empty and confused as to who we are. So, for example, when we are struggling with alcoholism, we become consumed with the cycle of seeking out, using, and recovering from drinking. Or maybe we just never stop drinking when we are awake. And so when we get sober, we may not recognize ourselves. We may feel a sense of emptiness or confusion as to who we are. And in some cases, we may revert back to the same habits that were problematic for us just because they were familiar. So what do we do? Well, the first thing we need to do is validate that this experience, that everything feels new when we are in recovery, is unfortunately very normal and natural. It means that we are disconnecting from patterns of addiction, depression, and anxiety, and open to exploring new ways of thinking, feeling, behaving, and connecting with others. So this is scary, but ultimately a good phase of our recovery. The second thing we can do is tell ourselves that while everything may feel new, there may be more of ourselves that we can figure out than we think. And we can start with the basic question of what experiences will be more likely to support sobriety and good feelings as compared to addiction, depression, or anxiety. For example, we will generally do better if we are in a regular sleep cycle, are eating 3 healthy meals a day, are exercising regularly, are productive in some way, and if we take the time to connect with others. If we do things we enjoy and find ways to cope with difficult emotions by understanding our feelings, we can find ways to address them without using alcohol. Now, as we explore these and other options, we can feel like we will build ourselves from the ground up. But one thing we have to be careful about is not to, as Pete said, become a snake that eats its own tail. Sometimes what may make us feel less anxious at the moment is to drink. Or we may feel that avoiding therapy or support groups will make us feel better in the moment. But making these choices may unfortunately undermine our ongoing recovery. As we explore our new selves, we have to embrace this feeling of being new, build ourselves into the people we want to be slowly, and make sure we don't fall into the trap of being the snake that eats its own tail. I want to thank Pete for this wonderful conversation. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. This season of Going There is also brought to you by AbbVie, who is driving the pursuit of better mental health. Over the last 30 years, AbbVie's scientists and clinicians have worked to tackle the complexity of mental illness, and today offer a portfolio of medicines and a pipeline of innovation that spans depression, anxiety, bipolar 1 disorder, and schizophrenia. To learn more about AbbVie's work to support individuals throughout their mental health journey, please visit www.abbvie.com or follow at AbbVie on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And also, this episode of Going There is brought to you by Alkermes. Alkermes is a global biopharmaceutical company developing innovative medicines in the field of neuroscience with products that treat alcohol dependence, opioid dependence, schizophrenia, and bipolar 1 disorder. To learn more, please visit Alkermes' website at www.alkermes.com or follow at Alkermes on Twitter and LinkedIn. And I, of course, want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and Sound Mind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or addiction and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. If you're thinking about harming yourself and want to seek help, please contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. You may also go to the Sound Mind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back for season 4. I'm Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.